as the kids are saying these days, hey fam, it's been 3 weeks since we were last together. I don't know about you, but that's way too long. I enjoyed the race car. I won a race car a couple weeks ago. That was a lot of fun. Although I always feel bad because somebody has to lose. Most have to lose. And that's the sad part, that you have to see their little, bunch of little kids disappointed, and they made me a judge, which is a horrible decision, over who had the best, not the best dress, but the best decorated race cars. And that was also difficult, because some kids, again, were inevitably disappointed, and that was sad. But I'm thankful that we're back together. We're plodding our way through Leviticus. I had aspirations of getting done with Leviticus, just breezing through it, and then God said snow's going to come, and there was snow, the 11th plague, I think, and it's just, we've been making our way through it.
It's because you were being prideful, saying, I can do this.
God got me. He got me. It's not about me.
Gotcha.
Thank you for keeping me humble.
Should I be the only one?
That's right. We're in that same boat, aren't we? So, as we get started, let me start us off with in prayer, and then we're just going to jump right into it, okay? So let's go to the Lord in prayer. Father, you are wonderful and kind and gracious and just giving in so many ways to us. Lord, you give us more than we deserve, and we thank you for that. Father, help us to trust in you. Help us to look to you in all things. Give us belief in every aspect, and Lord, may you be glorified with our study tonight in Leviticus. We ask this in your name. Amen. Okay, so I realize and recognize that we need to have a little bit of a recap, because if you're like me, just even 2 weeks seems like a long time, otherwise three, and then if for some reason maybe you haven't been with us, then maybe it's been a whole month since you've been able to be a part of us in Leviticus. So we're going to be dealing with Leviticus chapters 11 through 15 today. So we kind of are going to get past the midway point here with Leviticus chapters 11 through 15. Before we do that, though, let me recap the themes of how we are breaking apart the book of Leviticus. If you remember from week one, which has been a long time ago, so that's why I wanted to bring this up here. There's four here, going to be one on the next slide. And before I'd even do that, you have the slides. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit absent-minded. You have the slides. I gave you the slides this week because there were four of us who came last week, and we just decided we're not going to go over everything, and a couple of you said, hey, it would be nice to actually have the slides so I could take notes next to the slides. And I said, okay. And I asked, does that mean that everybody's going to look ahead and not pay attention with where we are? And those ladies said no. So if you start to do that, I'll have to scold you. Take those papers back, and then we'll have a big problem on our hands. I'm kidding, of course. So my only request would be to stay focused with where we're at. I assure you we'll try to get as far as we can, as much as we're able to. But that way, if you're wanting to take notes and you're thinking, oh, you know, I need to think about that, or that's a good point, or maybe I need to think about this in a different way, you'll be able to write that down with the slide and where we're at the slide. Now, again, with that being said, so when we are talking about Leviticus, so far we're kind of at the halfway point. The first theme of Leviticus is the first seven chapters that deals primarily with the sacrifices. We spent two weeks talking about the sacrifices, addressing sin, and enabling right worship. Coming out of Exodus, the problem is a holy God cannot be in the midst of an unholy people. That's a problem. How is a holy God going to be in the midst of an unholy people? It's through sacrifices, taking away the sin. Which that then led to the second theme, is what about who are going to be leading these unholy, becoming holy people, and that's the priests. So in chapters 8 through 10, we talked about the priests interceding for the people and leading them in that right worship of sacrifices. We're now to the third main theme, which that is getting to the law. And most of the rest of the book of Leviticus now, from chapters 11 through chapter 27, is going to be law, which I'm going to tell you is going to seem perhaps not super exciting. How would you like to just read through a book of laws, right? You don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. After a while, it might seem monotonous if we don't know the importance of what we're reading or why it's necessary for our lives. But here, we're going to deal in verses 11 through 15 with impurities among the people. That's going to be a big thing. We're really going to hit that next week, the idea of cleanliness and uncleanliness. And we'll kind of get into specifics of that. Today, we're really going to focus on how do we understand these laws. For instance, we're really going to hit on, do these laws still apply? Has anyone recently read through chapters 11 through 15 or even parts of chapters 11 through 15? They're kind of bizarre, right? Chapter 11, as we'll see here in a moment, is going to be about what you can eat versus what you are not supposed to eat, right? Chapters 12 and 13 are going to be this, or mostly chapter 12, are what about bleeding and bodily functions that make you unclean? And then what about leprosy in the house of a leper and all of these things? And we think, wait a second, is that still in effect? Is that still, should that be a part of my life? Do I need to change the way I do things based off of what we're going to see in these chapters? We're going to be talking about what that looks like to help us understand these chapters. The fourth theme that we'll get to in Deo Vum, Lord willing, a couple of weeks is Leviticus 16. Just one chapter. We'll probably only spend 1 week on that. That's the Day of Atonement. That is God taking away the sin and the impurity of his people. And then the fifth theme is the biggest, and that's Leviticus 17 through 27. That is back to law, but that's going to be the Israelites living like a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, giving us a whole lot of specifics of what their lives should look like being part of God's people. So when we're talking about the themes of Leviticus, this is the way that I have broken down the book of Leviticus, and this is the way that we're trying to go through it. So with that being said, let's jump then into this third theme, the importance, the necessity of the law. So following the priestly obedience, notice the obedience in chapter 9, we saw that now about a month ago, and then the priestly disobedience of chapter 10, that is Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, in chapters 11 through 15, we're going to see that God is going to further define his relationship with Israel. And it's going to be through the sets of laws that he's going to give his people. As we're going to see tonight, law is going to be an important principle of understanding God, and more specifically, understanding God's relationship to his people. The law is going to be the greatest text of understanding God, his people, and his faithfulness to his people, primarily because we see that Israel failed on their end of the agreement. The covenant that Israel was to keep with God, they failed. And yet God still cared for his people. He still loved his people. He still provided for them. He still rebuked them. He still disciplined them. And he still kept his promises to them. This is a God who is faithful even in the midst of being betrayed and those who are supposed to be obedient being disobedient. So the relationship between God and his people is going to be further defined here in the law section of the Mosaic Covenant. Throughout the remainder of Leviticus, I just kind of mentioned this a little bit ago, we're going to see a whole lot more laws. So really just buckle in, because we're going to see a lot of different laws. Some of them will be what I would consider interesting, hot button issues. Homosexuality is going to come up in chapter 18, right? Different sexual deviations are going to be coming up, but then also some things that maybe we don't think are that significant are going to come up as well. So we're going to see what does it look like for Israel to be spiritually clean versus spiritually unclean. That's going to be coming up here in these chapters. In doing so, God's going to teach Israel about his character. And I've said this before in Exodus, but it bears repeating. And some of this we'll have already heard, but we need to make sure that we understand it rightly. When we talk about the law of God, we are seeing God more clearly, right? When you see somebody's law that they've given to somebody else, you're seeing what matters most to them. So I always use this example when I'm teaching or something like that. Sorry, Miss Jean, you're going to be the one singled out. If I were to say, I guess Miss Gail also, don't wear a red shirt, right? I despise red shirts. That's not a good color to wear. You would say, okay, this guy's got some sort of weird past problem and experience with red shirts. And that kind of tells you something about me. Maybe he's a little bit odd. He's strange or something. But that tells you about me, what I prefer, what I like, and what I dislike. Same thing with the law of God. When God says, don't do this, right, and rather do this, that's telling us about the nature, the character, who this God is, right? Which, by the way, that's what all of Scripture does. In the new members class this morning, we were talking about how the gospel, that God's word alone, defines who God is. We only know about who God is in detail because of his word. Ultimately, it's through his word. Yes, creation bears witness. Yes, experience bears witness. But ultimately, it comes through his word. Same thing through the law. The law teaches us about our God, what he loves and hates. It also teaches us, as you can see on your slides, on the slide and in the handout, also this teaches us what God requires from his creation. We are not living, mankind does not live according to our own preferences, right? If we did, that would be anarchy. That's what that is. It's anarchy. There's unfortunately none left. Yeah, sorry, we handed them all out. I'll give you my slides afterwards, my handout. Wow, look at that. Just out of thin air, they started popping up. It's amazing. So it's this idea that without laws, we would have no idea what to do. But yet God says this is what you are to do because this is what God requires of his creation. And this also, the laws teach us the standard of what goodness is. Without laws, we would not know what good even is. Law teaches us these things. And we're going to jump into this in quite a bit of detail. So therefore, the third section of Leviticus, again, that's chapters 11 through 15, is about the laws given to deal with the impurities of the people. It might be a little bit awkward once you start reading some of these chapters. I'll be honest with you, chapter 12 was a little bit of an uncomfortable chapter for me, just because it's not something that I normally read about or think about. And yet, those are the things that the Lord is teaching us about what is required. So let's then jump into this in specifics. When we look at these laws, we kind of start breaking it down into the understanding of what we would call the ceremonial laws. And I'm going to try to give this explanation. We talked about this over a year ago, but I really want to make sure that we're understanding, are these laws still applicable to us? And so what I'm going to try to do over the next 15 minutes or so is give an explanation and understanding of, are these laws still applicable to you and me today? And if they're not, is God schizophrenic? Right? Is God the type of God that's going to say at one time, do this, and then at another time say, whoa, that was crazy. I don't know why I ever said that. Right? Is God this kind of two-faced person or deity saying one thing to one person and then another to another? So we're going to try to understand how do we consider these things. So we could call specifically chapters 11 through 15 and even much more beyond that, as you'll see here in a moment, we could call this section of the law of God, as some people do, the ceremonial laws. This is to say that these laws give instruction for which animals are clean or unclean to eat and to be used sacrificially. Right, so if you know anything about Jewish people, what is the main animal that they do not eat? A pig, right? Why do they not eat pigs? Because it's in the law. It's right here, right? It's literally here in chapter 11. If it has a divided hoof and it chews all of these things that you're not supposed to eat, the law talks about it. So they look at the law. They say, look, God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And we all say amen. And they say, that's why we don't eat the pig, right? That's why we're kosher, because the law says not to do it. And so they say, this is the ceremonial part of the law. Says what you're to eat and what you're not to eat, as well as then determining whether a person is ceremonially clean or unclean. Now, what does that mean? Again, we're going to talk about that much more in depth next week. But being ceremonially clean means you can go into the presence of God. Okay? You are justified. You are good in that standing. For whatever the reason is, you're clean in that standing to go before God. If you are unclean, you cannot go in the presence of God. You will be killed. You will be punished. So that's why there's going to be a lot of descriptions, detailed descriptions, sometimes even awkwardly detailed descriptions of what makes you ceremonially unclean. The idea here is, if you are ceremonially unclean, you cannot sacrifice to God. You cannot go to the tent of the tabernacle and worship God. You must be, here it is, removed from the camp until you're made clean again, right? So if you have... So women, for instance, in chapter 12, right? If it's the time when you're bleeding through the month, you have to be outside the camp, removed from the worship. And then when you are done, then you have to be ceremonially clean again, purified, and then you're back in it. If you have leprosy, chapter 13, this is the idea that if you have these scabs, you have to be outside the camp until then a priest can say, yes, that is gone, it's no longer applicable, you can now be welcomed back in, sacrifices made on your behalf, you're made clean. That's the idea of clean and unclean, pure and impure, or unpure. Okay, so that's the distinction that we're talking about. And the ceremonially clean and unclean, that's all getting into the ceremonial laws. And that's what we're seeing here. Now, to understand the ceremonial law, I debated whether to get the chalkboard out. I didn't get that out. So, but you have your piece of paper in front of you, so hopefully this will help you. Normally, when we're making distinctions within the law, we're talking about the law and what you see on the slide as a tripartite dynamic. So tri, it has three in it. Partite is dividing, so it's dividing the law into three: the moral, the civil, and the ceremonial. Now, you can see the way that I've worded this, and I worded it intentionally. Some Christians understand the law in this way. I'm going to explain to you how some people understand the law in this way, and then I'm going to tell you why I don't think this is the most helpful. I think there are some aspects that can be helpful with this, understanding what is kind of the intention of the law, but we'll get into maybe why the New Testament shows us a little bit of a different understanding, at least in my very humble opinion. But so some Christians are going to divide the law into ceremonial, civil, and moral. Again, this is the Mosaic law. This is what God gave to Moses on Mount Sinai, the law for Israel to live under. Okay, so in such a division, how do we understand this tripartite division? Well, when we look at the moral laws, these are what we might consider the Ten Commandments. These are the laws that have that huge moral element to it. Okay, so what we would think of as moral issues, like don't kill one another. Right, that's a very moral issue. Don't steal, right? Don't commit theft. Don't kidnap. Don't do things on the Sabbath day. Don't disobey your father and your mother. These are moral commandments, right? This is what we normally think of when we think of the law. At least if you're like me, when you think of the law, you think of these moral imperatives: what to do and what not to do. The civil and the ceremonial are a little bit different. These maybe go a little bit underneath the curb, as it were. The civil laws are going to be laws which, as you can see, talk about punishment and disobedience and how to solve disputes. So, for instance, what happens to a person if they kidnap someone else? What is the punishment? The civil law talks about that. What about if two neighbors have a dispute over an animal? Where does that fall under? That's the civil law. Wonder if this idea of if your animal does this thing to another animal, how do you write? This is all falling under the civil side of the law. This is the idea that if you've done something, what happens to you? This is the idea of government, really, is what this is getting at. This is the idea of government, of punishments, rectifying, and resolution between people and property and these types of things. But then there's the ceremonial law, which that's really what we're dealing with. And the ceremonial law is specifically defined of how do we worship God, right? This is going to be a main focus. And what is ceremonially unclean, clean, and what to eat. So the ceremonial laws are going to be heavy emphasis on worshiping God. So what do you do in the Tent of Tabernacle? What are the priests to do? Who are the priests? What do they wear? All of these fall into the ceremonial laws. What about the sacrifices? What about the way you give the sacrifices? What about the things, which one do you go to depending on the situation? That's ceremonial law. What about when you can offer sacrifices, when you can't offer sacrifices, and when you can worship God or not? That's our chapters. This is going to be ceremonial law. To give a more complete look at it, here's a bunch of examples. In fact, these are all of the 27 chapters, a few chapters missing, but chapters 1 through 6, about the six sacrifices, the five sacrifices, that's ceremonial law. Chapter 11, the animals that you can eat, as we've mentioned, that's ceremonial law. Chapter 12, female cleanliness, that's also chapter 12. 13 through 15, leprosy and bodily uncleanliness, that's ceremonial. And then assortment of other laws, which are just so numerous. The Bible calls them the sundry laws because they're just a lot of them. You can't list them out unless you have a long list. These are all what we consider ceremonial laws. Okay, so does that make sense how the law is split up in a tripartite division? Is that making sense how it's split up between moral, civil, and ceremonial? Moral is the right thing, the wrong thing. Civil, it's the more government resolution and punishment, and ceremonial, what you should do when you're worshiping God, how to do that, who does it, and all those sorts of things. Okay, well then let's jump to understanding, is this the best way of understanding the law? Because it really makes no sense. And let me again show my cards. I just want you to know where I'm coming from here. If we don't understand how to understand the law, then we're going to get lost in this bog of really bizarre laws. And if we don't have a right understanding from this point on, the rest of Leviticus will make little sense to us. Parts of Numbers will make little sense to us, and for sure Deuteronomy, which hits home with a lot of laws during Moses' sermons, we're just going to be like, I don't understand. What's the significance of this? And we'll be tempted to want to throw out these parts of the Old Testament. We can't do that. So, is this biblical? So, understanding the Mosaic law and the tripartite distinction, that again, that's moral, civil, ceremonial, means what it's saying is that Christ completed two-thirds of the law. That is to say that when Jesus came, he completed the civil, because it's no longer a government of Israel, and he completed the ceremonial, right? This is the priesthood of the believer. We now are made righteous through Jesus. But it did not complete the moral law. The moral imperatives never end. They just continue on. So two out of three are completed by Jesus. Could somebody look up Matthew 5:17, or maybe does somebody have that memorized? It's where Jesus says how he's in relation to the law. Would somebody be able to look that up? Or starts out, I did not come to abolish the law, but to what? To fulfill the law. That's what Jesus says, right? So in a tripartite understanding of the law, Jesus is saying there, I'm not abolishing the law, right? Not completely, I'm fulfilling it. Two out of three are done and over, but the third continues. So that's the way that this understanding is going forth. Now there's a lot of historical reputability also with understanding the tripartite distinction. So they draw from Matthew 5:17, men of church history, we would call these church patriarch men, such as Thomas Aquinas, who was a hugely influential person, I think in the 300 to 400s, Origen, who was earlier than that, and Jerome, who had a huge Latin translation that a lot of our translations have drawn from. All of these men understood the law in this distinction. So we have to ask the question, did Jesus complete all of the law or only part of the law? And then here's the bigger question that I personally have had to wrestle with. So let's just say, hypothetically speaking, if only two-thirds of the law is completed by Jesus and the other third continues, is the Mosaic law, that is the Old Covenant, still in effect? Does that make sense? The Old Covenant, which was started through Abraham and the Abrahamic Covenant, further defined in the Mosaic Covenant, the law, that's the Old Covenant, is that still continuing in any way? Or is it done, and is there something new, completely new? That's the big question, and that's what I've had to wrestle with. Does that make sense? We're trying to build from what we've talked about in Genesis all the way to here, because all of this our stacks going up the stairs. And if we miss the first couple of stairs, then we don't get to the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth. Okay, here's another couple of questions. And if somebody would like to turn to Acts chapter 10, I'd love for somebody to read that for us. I do not have those seven verses memorized. But how do we then understand if the tripart distinction of the law, breaking it up into these three distinct areas, Jesus only fulfilled two but not the third, how then do we understand passages like Acts chapter 10? Acts chapter 10 should be somewhat familiar because we were there not too long ago. It's when Peter has this vision when God tells him to eat the animals that in chapter 11 God says don't eat. Somebody have Acts chapter 10, verses 10 through 16, and be willing to read that out loud? All right, Miss Jean, yeah. Go ahead and read that for us if you would. Acts chapter 10, verses 10 through 16.
Descending to him and let down to the earth. In it were all kinds of four-footed animals of the earth, wild beasts, creeping things, and birds of the air. And a voice came to him, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." But Peter said,
Verse 16.
Mm-hmm. But Peter said, "Not so, Lord, for I have never eaten anything common or unclean." And a voice spoke to him again, the second time, "What God has cleansed, you must not call common." This was done three times, and the object was taken up into heaven again.
Okay, thank you so much. So, we see some kind of difficult things to wrestle with, right? If you read Leviticus chapter 11, and you read Acts chapter 10, you say, wait a second. God said don't do this in Leviticus 11, and now he's telling Peter, do this in Acts chapter 10. In fact, God says something really important, and I'm not opened up to Acts chapter 10, but he said, bless you, if I'm remembering correctly, what I have said is clean. Does he say, don't say that's unclean? Is that the language? Does anybody have it still there? Yeah, exactly right. So if I've said that it's clean or holy, don't say that it's not, right? No. But again, Peter could say, but God, I was just reading Leviticus 11. That's what you said. It's unclean. It's unholy. And anyone who eats that is also unholy, unclean, and cannot be in your presence. Right? So if the Mosaic covenant is still continuing, how do we reconcile these passages together? How is that going to work? Well, with that being said, I think to answer this question, we have to see clearly that the New Testament talks about, I believe, a total obsolescence of the Old Covenant. That is the Mosaic Law. And I would say even the Abrahamic Law, or the Abrahamic Covenant, because they're all so intrinsically tied together, that there's something new happening. That is the New Covenant. And instead of it being a law, or a covenant of law, so that's the Mosaic Law, or the Mosaic Covenant, a covenant of law, it's now going to be, hear the distinction, the covenant of grace. Okay? So the Old Testament is under the imperatives, that is the commands, of the covenant of law. But in the New Testament, we see something new entirely. We see a total fulfillment, not an absolution. So we're not going to throw it away, but it's resolved so that something new is given. Now, on this next slide, and what you see on your handouts, we have a lot of these verses, okay? And I want to look at a bunch of them because I think this is a really, really important thing for us to have a grasp on. So the first thing that we're going to look at, and I'm going to actually go through because we have enough that I think everybody can read here. So circumcision. Is circumcision still going on? That's the sign of the old covenant, right? You're circumcised, you're part of the family of God. Why? Because Abraham was circumcised. That was the sign of the Abrahamic covenant. kept going in the law. Is that still in effect? So you already read, so maybe we'll go to Miss Beverly. If you don't mind reading or looking up Romans chapter 4, verses 9 through 13, it's going to be that first passage up there. And then Miss Lane, do you mind looking up the next one, Galatians 2, 3 through 5? And then also in Galatians chapter 5, verse 2. So it's up there. Yeah, I know it's kind of a lot of numbers, but if you don't mind doing that. Miss Cindy, do you mind look up the next one, Philippians 3, 2 through 3? And then Jessica, the last one there, Colossians 2, 11 through 12. So we're going to really hit home in the New Testament of what is going on here. Is circumcision, that is the sign of the old covenant, right? Is that still being required for believers? That's going to be a big question because that's the sign of the covenant. All right, Miss Beverly, do you mind reading Romans 4, verses 9 through 13 for us? Yes, ma'am.
Now, is this blessing only for the Jews, or is it also for uncircumcised Gentiles? Well, we have been saying that Abraham was counted as righteous by God because of his faith. But how did this happen? Was he counted as a righteous? Was he counted as righteous only after he was circumcised? Or was it before he was circumcised? Clearly, God accepted Abraham before he was circumcised. Circumcision was a sign that Abraham already had faith and that God had already accepted him and declared him to be righteous even before he was circumcised. So Abraham is the spiritual father of those who have faith but have not been circumcised. They are counted as righteous because of their faith. And Abraham is also the spiritual father of those who have been circumcised, but only if they have the same kind of faith had before he was circumcised.
Okay, great. It's a lot of the word circumcised. Yeah. Right? If we do a word search on the New Testament of circumcised, this one's going to just blare at us, right? But what's he saying? Paul's in a very deep argument here, and he's making the case. You're not a son or a daughter of Abraham through circumcision. You're not a son of Abraham through circumcision. It's by what? His faith, right? And what does Paul say in Ephesians chapter 2? It is by grace you have been saved through faith. The marriage in the New Testament is faith is a work of grace, right? You're brought into the family of God not because of external means of circumcision, which, by the way, is what we're going to see about the law. It's external. Jesus goes internal. But what we see in the New Testament is you're a child of God that is following after Abraham, not by having a physical distinction like Abraham, but by having a spiritual distinction of Abraham. That is faith. And faith comes through grace. How do you have the faith of Abraham? Through the grace of God. How are you given the grace of God? When God says, you're my child, I'm bringing you into my family. That's the beautiful picture of the covenant of grace. So is covenants, or is the circumcision still continuing on? Paul's making the case here in Romans 4. It's not, because it's faith now, no longer circumcision. What about Galatians chapter 2, verses 3 through 5, and then also chapter 5, verse 2?
But not even Titus, who was with me, though he was a Greek, was compelled to be circumcised. But it was because of the false brethren secretly brought in, who had to spy on our liberty, which we have in Christ Jesus, in order to bring us into bondage. But we did not yield in subjection to them for even an hour, so that the truth of the gospel would remain with you.
Okay, just, yeah, really quickly. That's a spicy language here by Paul, right? They're sneaking in, these deceivers. Titus wasn't convinced. I don't need to be circumcised. I'm a Greek. I'm a Gentile. And then in verse 5, as she read, so that the truth of the gospel remains in you. What truth of the gospel? Don't be circumcised. Right? That's an external sign that no longer applies. don't be circumcised. Instead, follow the gospel. Chapter 5, verse 2.
Behold, I, Paul, say to you that if you have received circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you.
Holy cow. Okay. Paul's leaving no beating around the bush here, right? Not mincing words. If you are looking to circumcision to say that you are right, that is any external mean of the old covenant. I think he's saying if you're looking to anything of the old covenant and you're saying that's what makes you right. I've kept the law. I've done all of these good things. Paul says Christ will be of no benefit to you. Yikes. That sounds a whole lot like when Jesus says there will be many on that day who say, Lord, Lord, did I not do this in your name? And he says what? Depart from me, I never knew you. I was no benefit to you because you looked to yourself, your abilities, what you thought you could do. Paul's making a strong case against circumcision, and he's not mincing words. What about Philippians chapter 3, verses 2 through 3? Alright, those dogs, yikes, who do the false circumcision. Now, Paul's again making the case, if you're trying to do the old covenant, it means nothing to you, nothing to you. In fact, if you read on further in chapter 3, Paul makes the case, if anybody had confidence in the flesh of this external body of what they could do, I would be the one who would be able to boast. I have the confidence that I knew all these things. I followed all the regulations of the law. I committed my life to it, and it meant nothing. He says, the true circumcision are what? Those who worship in the Spirit of God and glory in Christ Jesus. Jesus is something different. Something's happening in Jesus that's different than anything of the old covenant. And then finally, Colossians 2, 11 through 12. Well, chew on those, well, it's a part of a longer sentence that we just jumped in there, but chew on what he's saying in Colossians chapter 2 when you get a chance. What he is saying here is, you are circumcised, Christian, but it's not by a man or a woman or a person. It's in your heart. And who does it? The Holy Spirit, who has taken away your flesh, cut off the flesh, right? It's the language of circumcision. It's intentional. And instead, you're baptized into the Spirit, made alive by Jesus Christ through the resurrection. That's a powerful argument that Paul's making here. So, again, there's so much more that could be said, but Paul's being really specific and intentional, and I think very clear here. The sign of the old covenant is completely gone. Why? Because the old covenant is completely gone. Well, let's continue on. What about the Passover, right? So one of the biggest celebrations of the Old Covenant was the Passover. So, we'll look at a few of these. You'll look at all three of these. Sadie, do you mind looking up Romans 14, 5 through 6? No? Yes? That's a good point. Yes. No, let's go back to Gail. I forgot. My wife has lost her voice. Ms. Gale, would you mind looking up Romans 14, 5 through 6? Pi, would you mind looking up Galatians chapter 4, verses 9 through 10? And then Trevor, do you mind looking up Colossians 2, 16 and 17? All right, so again, this is going to be about how the Passover or any specific days, weeks, celebrations, how this no longer is in application. All right, Ms. Gale, do you have that passage for us? Okay, so he's making this point. Some people think this day is important. Some people think that day is important. Some people think these days are important. What matters is, are you doing it for the Lord? If you don't want to eat pig, go for it. I don't care. God doesn't really care if you don't want to eat pig, as long as you're doing it for the Lord. You're wanting to serve the Lord, not serve yourself, not serve your own understanding and ideas. Same thing with the days, and this is the idea of the Passover. So Paul's making this idea that really there's not one day that's more important than the next, so Passover is not more significant than anything else. Pi, what about Galatians chapter 4, verses 9 through 10? And read verse 11 along with it.
I fear for you that perhaps I have labored over you in vain.
Yikes. This is a dad speaking to the spiritual children of deep disappointment. I'm afraid all of my work that I've been doing with you was for nothing. Why? Because they're trying to hold fast to the old covenant of Passover celebration, of circumcision, that everything is dependent upon the old covenant. He's saying it doesn't matter anymore. It's not applicable. And then Colossians chapter 2, verses 16 through 17, Trevor.
Therefore, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink, or with regard to a festival or a new year or a Sabbath. These are a shadow of the things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ.
Okay, thank you. Is there anything more clear than that? He just says these festivals, these celebrations, they're a shadow to what? What does he say? A shadow looking to what? To Christ, right? They're not eternal. Now, let me just quickly say this. Is there anything wrong with enjoying a Passover celebration? When Sadie and I were in Israel, we had Shabbat dinner, which is right before the Sabbath, right as the sun's going down and it's beginning the Sabbath. Not at all. We enjoyed the cultural thing of that. But there is a problem when you see, in order to be good with God, to be clean with God, you've got to do these things. The whole point that we're making here is all of the New Testament is making the case it's not about keeping the law or the law continuing on. All of it is something that's disappeared in Christ. Sacrifices and temple worship, I kind of just punted here. The entire book of Hebrews talks about how the sacrifices and temple worship are no longer applicable. So read the entire book of Hebrews and you'll get his argument. There's just no really easy way to parse it. Food and purity regulations. For the sake of time, let's not look any of these up. I would recommend out of these, Mark chapter 7, 18 through 23. That's Jesus talking. So if you want to see what Jesus is saying about these things, look to Mark chapter 7. And then the last one that we... And then Sabbath, you also have Romans 14, Colossians 2, Hebrews 3 through 4. Again, how the Sabbath is no longer an actual physical day, but it's something very different. And then the entirety of the law. And I'm going to ask Meredith, if you have a Bible, if you'd look up Hebrews chapter 8, verse 13, because really what the author of Hebrews does is he just kind of boils it all down into one statement. And I think this is what we really need to see about all of these verses. So again, the whole point in this slide is for you to have New Testament evidence of saying, look, New Testament is speaking succinctly and I think pretty clearly that it's no longer about anything in the Old Covenant, but it's all about something new in Jesus. All right, Meredith, do you have Hebrews 8:13 for us? Pretty basic, right? Pretty standard. He made the first obsolete. The first what? The first covenant. Whatever's becoming obsolete grows old and is ready to disappear, replaced by a new. That's what Jesus did. He replaced the old with the new. So this is why we say the Mosaic Law and its absolution. Okay, so then jumping to New Testament grace. Let me show this slide and then see what somebody says about it. But therefore, From what I see, the New Testament seems to most clearly indicate, at least to me, from my studies and what I see, what I'm convinced of, that the New Testament is not a covenant of law, but it's a covenant of grace, meaning that Christ fulfilled in totality the old covenant, which is to say, especially the Mosaic covenant. Let me read Romans 6:14, because this also says it very clearly. Paul says, "For sin shall not be master over you." Listen to this. "For you are not under law, but under," what word do you think he's going to say? Grace. Sin, or law, was a slave over you. You're not over that, or that's not over you anymore. You're not under law, but you're under grace. He's saying a lot here with sin being a master over you, law, that exposing it. But he's saying that you're under a covenant of grace now. This grace is Jesus Christ. So the standard of holiness for New Testament Christians is living and obeying the commands of Jesus. That's going to be the most vital aspect of this now. The sign of the covenant is going to be the faith of Abraham, but it's going to be clearly the commands, the teachings, let us be clear, the life of Jesus. Jesus says, "You'll know that you love me if you do what? You keep my commandments." 1 John would say, you know that you love the Lord, you know that you love him if you keep his commandments. What does it look like to live in a covenant of grace? You're living according to the life of Jesus, which is why we're called Christians, little followers of Christ, little Christs. This is the covenant of grace. Now, what does this mean? This means in practicality, and I know that we're getting into some hairy stuff here. I'm just trying to pull it out so we can apply it. This means that Christians are no longer called to the laws of the Old Covenant. No longer called to the laws of the Old Covenant, which is such as Leviticus, but you and I are called to actually a higher standard than the laws of the Old Covenant. Now, that's not normally what you think of when you read through these laws of Leviticus. You think, whoa, look at all these crazy laws. Man, they really had to live in a really different way. The standard that you and I are called to live to is much greater, much higher, and much more impossible than what the law gave in the Pentateuch. As I say here, we are called to, we see that the higher standard of holiness is what the New Testament sets, rendering perfection absolutely unattainable. You might say, how is the covenant of grace more impossible than the covenant of the law? Jesus' teaching on the Mount says it's not just about physically committing the act of sin, it's internally believing, dwelling, and doing inside that's also sin. The covenant of grace says you've broken the standard of God not just by stealing, but by desiring to steal. You've broken the commandment, right? And this is Matthew chapter 6 here. You've broken the commandment of murder by not just physically pulling the trigger, but by hating your brother, hating your sister. This is a higher standard than what the law is saying. Why? Because Jesus is showing you and I can't do it. We can't do it. This covenant of grace, hey Max, this covenant of grace is something that's even greater, even higher, and even more impossible for us to attain than anything of the law. Now, then let's see what Schreiner says about this. See if you have any questions, and then I want to make sure we don't drop off on the other side of the boat, the proverbial boat. So this is what Tom Schreiner says, professor at Southern Seminary. He was an elder in the church that Sadie and I were a part of before we came here. He says, quote, "is perhaps instructive to note that in most instances, Paul does not argue that the moral norms from the Old Testament are authoritative on the basis of their appearance in the Old Testament, though in some instances he does cite the Old Testament command." He gives a couple examples in Romans 13 and Ephesians 6. He says, "They are not normative merely because they appear in the Mosaic covenant, for that covenant has passed away," Hebrews 8. "It seems that they are normative because they express the character of God. We know that they still express God's will for believers because they are repeated as moral norms in the New Testament." So these imperatives, these commands, are in the New Testament. So that's going to be why it's continuing to us. He continues to say, It is not surprising that in the welter of the laws we find in the Old Covenant, some of the rabbis say 613, that some of those laws express transcendent moral principles. Still, the mistake we make is trying to carve up neatly the law into moral and non-moral categories. He's talking about the tripart division of the law: moral, civil, ceremonial, which is what I'm trying to say. I don't think that's the most helpful. So this is how Schreiner speaks on it. Certainly he's not the only one. It's the way that many others as well look at it. So does that make sense, that there's something completely new in the New Testament going on? And when you and I look at the Old Testament law, specifically Leviticus 11 through 15, we're not looking at something that you and I need to go home and now start implementing, because something else is completely going on here. Now, the question's going to be, well, then what's going on here? And then the more specific question is, can we just throw the baby out with the bathwater? That's what I'm going to answer on the next slide, or at least try to answer. But any questions or thoughts at this point? Say again.
The only way to avoid breaking the law is for there be no law to break.
Well, the standards of the law are still in effect in that it shows us our sin, right? So therefore, it shows us that we cannot do it, but it's even higher than that. So it's like the law got a couple of steps, and then Jesus is showing it's actually even higher. The line... of what we must be to be holy with God is even more so than what the law says. So the law gets us, as we could say, only halfway there. Jesus completes it by completing the law and showing us how he's the only one who can attain it. Is that what you mean? I'm not trying to argue for antinomianism, if that's what you mean, of that we're lawless, that we no longer have any code.
How would you know right from wrong?
Yes. Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
At the beginning, yeah. Yeah, I made that comment, yeah.
And so it got me thinking, what law did Adam and Eve break? And what law did Cain break before there was a law?
Yeah. I think the law that's inside of us, right, the law of conscience. Adam and Eve, definitely, they were said, don't do this. I mean, that's law.
God.
Right. But yeah, God had said, Genesis chapter 2, or is it Genesis chapter 3 at the beginning, don't eat of this. So that's a law, right? That's a command. Now Cain, that's a good one too, because at no point had it said yet, don't kill others, right? They hadn't said that. That doesn't come until later. But yet the law of conscience on our minds, which is a little bit of a different but similar, I think that all of us have that ingrained within us.
But he was still punished.
Agreed, yeah. Well, I would say it did exist in the conscience, right? So you could have the proverbial person in the in an island, completely without any government, without anybody else, and would they still be a sinner? Yes, because what's on their conscience says they know that this is wrong. There's something within us innately that teaches us something's wrong. I don't need other people to tell me that what I'm doing is wrong, because I know it within myself. I think that's the thing with Cain. He knew that what he had done was wrong because of the law upon his conscience. But that's a really good point, Harry. That's a really good point. And I've had to wrestle with that recently.
But doesn't Paul talk about the Gentiles having the law written on their hearts?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, which is why we can say the tribesman in Africa is still morally responsible to God, and why God is justified in condemning that person if he doesn't repent and follow, become a son of Abraham. Yeah. Really, these are huge topics and good topics. I really like that question. Okay, well, we're coming to the end, and we're coming to the end of our time and not the end of the session, but I want to answer this question. The ceremonial laws, and again, I'm just kind of using that because that's an easy way of describing it. Is it still relevant today? I'm not trying to just call people out by name. Now, but there's a pastor, so Charles Stanley's son, Andy Stanley, he's a pastor in Atlanta, and He has said about the law recently, and I haven't heard him recant this or take it back, so I can only assume he still believes it and teaches it, but he says we need to unhitch ourselves from the Old Testament. That is to say, yours and my faith has nothing to do with the Old Testament. Leave it in the past, come into the future. The future is only the New Testament. So the question that we have to ask ourselves is there any significance in studying chapters 11 through 15? Right? Is there any value to us saying this is the Word of God? Or is it just, well, I guess that's how God used to do things, and I guess it's significant. I think there's a whole lot of significance to what these laws say, not just in the historical perspective, but what God's saying and what that should mean to us today. Let me be very, very clear. I wholeheartedly reject what Andy Stanley was teaching there. I hope that he's recanted. I hope that he's gone, understood it in a different way. But we need the Old Testament just as much as the New. You cannot have one without the other. That's why we're doing this. What we're going to talk about next week are five reasons and more that the Old Testament law is absolutely vital for us to understand today. I'm not going to jump into 1, 2, and 3 because we want to get to all five of them at the same time. So it's 6:15. This is about a good enough time as any to stop. And then we'll keep going next week with five reasons why the law is vital. And then we're going to talk specifically of what does it mean to be clean and unclean, and what does that mean for us today in a modern context. Okay, so, that's a good, I'm going to be thinking about that even more. I really like the question about Cain. Why was a sacrifice not pleasing to God? We talked about that a couple months ago, didn't we, Miss Elaine? Yeah. Any other questions or thoughts? Or I know we kind of maybe stepped big picture, but I promise next week we really will get more specific. Yes, Sadie. Yes, really good question. We had talked about that a little bit. So Awana ends, I think, the first or second Sunday in May, and then Awana will be stopping. So my goal is to conclude Leviticus by that time. And then we might have one extra week, depending on if we're able to get through the material. If we do have an extra week, then maybe we'll just have kind of a question and answer time. Maybe we'll put together just kind of a week study on just one issue of something that might be interesting. At this point, I'm thinking that we'll probably be taking the summer off as we normally do, but I'll continue praying about that. And if you guys have thoughts on it, certainly let me know. But that's kind of where I'm at right now. We'll talk about it maybe as we get a little bit closer. Yeah, any other questions? All right. Well, thank you so much again for being here. I know that we kind of broadened it out instead of being specifically, minutely focused. I hope that that's helping us understand the law. I think that's a vital thing to understand. Otherwise, first five books of the Bible are going to make a little sense to us. Before we go to the Lord in prayer, are there any ways that we can be in prayer for you or your loved ones? Yeah. Sadie's sister, so our brother-in-law, he's traveling back to Ohio, and she's staying here with her parents because she's going to start a job in a week, and this is kind of her last little bit of free time before she becomes a full-time nurse. So she's able to be home with her parents for a little bit. I mentioned this in the new members class that started this morning, and please be in prayer for the new members class. We had a great time. I think we've got a good group. Looking forward to seeing some people become formally a part of the church. But I have a student. She's in my New Testament online class, so we never meet in person. Her name is Desiree, and she asked for prayer, and I asked for you guys to pray for her. Her father in Kentucky attempted to commit suicide, was unsuccessful, but is on life support. And I think she had to make the decision either late last week or early this week of whether or not to take him off the ventilator. You're talking about a young lady who's somewhere around 18 to 22 years old, somewhere around that. So if you would be in prayer for Desiree, I mean, it's just never met her, probably won't meet her. But there's just, you could just you're going to feel the pain coming through an email of just somebody who's broken, doesn't know what to do or why it's happening. So I'd appreciate your prayer for her. Anything else? Okay. Miss Elaine, would you like to close us in prayer tonight?